This is Audible.
Dewey, the small-town library cat who touched the world. Written by Vicki Myron with Brett Witter. Read by Suzanne Torin.
There is a 1,000-mile table of land in the middle of the United States, between the Mississippi River on the east and the deserts on the west. Out here, there are rolling hills, but no mountains. There are rivers and creeks, but few large lakes. The wind has worn down the rock outcroppings, turning them first to dust, then dirt, then soil, and finally to fine black farmland. Out here, the roads are straight, stretching to the horizon in long, unbroken lines. There are no corners, only occasional, almost imperceptible, bends. This land was surveyed and plotted for farms. The bends are corrections in the survey line. Exactly every mile, every road is intersected by another almost perfectly straight road. Inside is a square mile of farmland. Take a million of those square miles, lace them together, and you have one of the most important agricultural regions in the world. The Great Plains, the breadbasket, the heartland. Or, as many people think of it, the place you fly over on your way to somewhere else. Let them have the oceans and mountains, their beaches and their ski resorts. I'll take Iowa. In northwest Iowa, in winter, the sky swallows the farmhouses. On a cold day, the dark clouds that blow in across the plains seem to churn the land under like a plow. In the spring, the world is flat and empty, full of brown dirt and hacked-off corn stalks waiting to be plowed under, the sky and land perfectly balanced, like a plate on a stick. But if you come in the late summer, you would swear the ground is about to push up and tip the sky right out of the picture. The corn is 9 feet high, bright green leaves topped with brilliant gold tassels. That's what I love about northwest Iowa. It is always changing. Not in the way the suburbs change, as one chain restaurant replaces another, or the way cities change, as buildings crowd each other ever higher, but in the way the country changes, slowly back and forth in a gentle motion that is always sliding forward, but never very fast. There aren't many roadside businesses out here. No crafts stores, no farmers' markets. The farmhouses, which are fewer every year, hug the road. The towns pop up suddenly, bearing signs announcing the jewel in the crown of Iowa, or the gold buckle on the corn belt, and disappear just as quickly. 2 minutes, and they're gone. A grain elevator or a processing plant, maybe a downtown strip with a convenience store, a place to eat. Every 10 miles or so, there's a roadside cemetery, small, plain markers behind low stone walls. These are pioneer plots that grew into extended family plots and eventually into town cemeteries. Nobody wants to be buried far from home, and nobody wants to waste much land. Use what you have. Make it simple. Keep it local. Then, just when you're sliding away, when you're drifting into complacency like a cornrow down the backside of a rise, the road widens and you pass a strip of stores. Mat Furniture, the Iron Horse Hotel, the Prime Rib Restaurant, but also a Walmart, a McDonald's, a Motel 6. Turn north at the stoplight, the first turn in 50 miles, no matter which direction you've been driving, not to mention the first stoplight, and within a minute you've left the chains behind and you're driving the beautiful low bridge over the Little Sioux River right into the heart of Spencer, Iowa, a town that hasn't changed much since 1931. Downtown Spencer is picture postcard small town America. Rows of storefronts in connecting 2- and 3-story buildings where people pull their cars to the curb, get out, and walk. White Drug, Eddie Quinn's Men's Clothing, and Stefan Furniture have been in business for decades. The Hen House sells decorating items to farm wives and the occasional tourist on her way to the Iowa Lake Country 20 miles north. There's a hobby shop specializing in model airplanes, a card shop, and a store that rents oxygen tanks and wheelchairs. The vacuum cleaner store, Arts on Grand. The old movie theater is still in business, although it shows only second-run movies since a 7-screen Cineplex opened south of the bridge. The downtown ends at The Hotel, 8 blocks from the bridge. The Hotel. That's the actual name. It was known as the Tagney in the late 1920s, when it was the area's best accommodation, bus depot, train station, and only sit-down restaurant. By the end of the Great Depression, it had become a flophouse, and, according to legend, the town bordello. The 5-story building, plain red brick and built to last, was eventually abandoned, then rehabilitated in the 1970s. But by then, the real action had moved 5 blocks down Grand Avenue to Sister's Main Street Cafe, a no-frills diner with formica tables, drip coffee, and smoky booths. 3 groups of men congregate every morning at Sister's. The old guys, the older guys, and the really old guys. Together, they have run Spencer for the past 60 years. Around the corner from Sister's Cafe, across a small parking lot and just 1/2 block off Grand Avenue, is a low, gray, concrete building, the Spencer Public Library. My name is Vicky Myron, and I've been working in that library for 25 years, the last 20 as director. I've overseen the arrival of the first computer and the addition of the reading room. I've watched children grow up and leave, only to walk back through the doors 10 years later with their own children. The Spencer Public Library may not look like much, at least not at first, but it is the centerpiece, the middle ground, the heart of this Heartland story. Everything I'm going to tell you about Spencer all flows back eventually to this small gray building and to the cat who lived here for more than 19 years. How much of an impact can an animal have? How many lives can one cat touch? How is it possible for an abandoned kitten to transform a small library into a meeting place and tourist attraction, inspire a classic American town, bind together an entire region, and eventually become famous around the world? You can't even begin to answer those questions until you hear the story of Dewey Read More Books, the beloved library cat of Spencer, Iowa. January 18th, 1988, was a bitterly cold Iowa Monday. The night before, the temperature had reached minus 15 degrees, and that didn't take into account the wind, which cut under your coat and squeezed your bones. It was a killing freeze, the kind that made it almost painful to breathe. I have never been a morning person, especially on a dark and cloudy January day, but I have always been dedicated. There were a few cars on the road at 7:30 when I drove the 10 blocks to work, but, as usual, mine was the first car in the parking lot. Across the street, the Spencer Public Library was dead. No lights, no movement, no sound, until I flipped a switch and brought it to life. The heater switched on automatically during the night, but the library was still a freezer first thing in the morning. Whose idea was it to build a concrete and glass building in northern Iowa? I needed my coffee. I went immediately to the library staff room, nothing more than a kitchenette with a microwave and a sink, a refrigerator, too messy for most people's taste, a few chairs, and a phone for personal calls. hung up my coat, and started the coffee. "Good morning, Vicky," said Jean Hollis Clark, the assistant library director, taking off her scarf and mittens. "It's a mean one out there." "Good morning, Jean," I said. In the center of the staff room, against the back wall, was a large metal box with a hinged lid. The box was 2 feet high and 4 feet square, about the size of a two-person kitchen table if you sawed the legs in half. A metal chute rose out of the top of the box, then disappeared into the wall. At the other end, in the alley behind the building, was a metal slot. The library's after-hours book return. You find all kinds of things in a library drop box. Garbage, rocks, snowballs, soda cans. Librarians don't talk about it, because it gives people ideas. But all libraries deal with it. Video stores probably have the same problem. After the weekend, the drop box would also be full of books. So every Monday, I loaded them onto one of our book carts so the clerks could process and shelve them later in the day. When I came back with the cart on this particular Monday morning, Jean was standing quietly in the middle of the room. "I heard a noise." "What kind of noise?" "From the drop box. I think it's an animal."
"A what?"
"An animal. I think there's an animal in the drop box." That was when I heard it, a low rumble from under the metal cover. It didn't sound like an animal. It sounded more like an old man struggling to clear his throat. But I doubted it was an old man. The opening at the top of the chute was only a few inches wide, so that would be quite a squeeze. It was an animal. I had little doubt of that. But what kind? I got down on my knees, reached over to the lid, and hoped for a chipmunk. The first thing I felt was a blast of freezing air. Someone had jammed a book into the return slot, wedging it open. It was as cold in the box as it was outside. Maybe colder, since the box was lined with metal. You could have kept frozen meat in there. I was still catching my breath when I saw the kitten. It was huddled in the front left corner of the box, its head down, its legs tucked underneath it, trying to appear as small as possible. The books were piled haphazardly to the top of the box, partially hiding it from view. I lifted one gingerly for a better look. The kitten looked up at me, slowly and sadly. Then it lowered its head and sank down into its hole. It wasn't trying to appear tough. It wasn't trying to hide. I don't even think it was scared. It was just hoping to be saved. I know melting can be a cliché, but I think that's what actually happened to me at that moment. I lost every bone in my body. I am not a mushy person. I'm a single mother and a farm girl who has steered her life through hard times. But this was so unexpected. I lifted the kitten out of the box. My hands nearly swallowed it. We found out later it was 8 weeks old, but it looked no more than 8 days old, if that. It was so thin I could see every rib. I could feel its heart beating, its lungs pumping. The poor kitten was so weak it could barely hold up its head, and it was shaking uncontrollably. It opened its mouth, but the sound, which came 2 seconds later, was weak and ragged. And cold. That's what I remember most, because I couldn't believe a living animal could be so cold. It felt like there was no warmth at all. So I cradled the kitten in my arms to share my heat. It didn't fight. Instead, it snuggled into my chest, then laid its head against my heart.
"Oh, my golly," said Jean.
"The poor baby," I said, squeezing tighter.
"It's adorable."
Neither of us said anything for a while. We were just staring at the kitten. Finally, Jean said,
"How do you think it got in there?"
I wasn't thinking about last night. I was only thinking about right now. It was too early to call the veterinarian, who wouldn't be in for an hour. But the kitten was so cold.
Even in the warmth of my arms, I could feel it shaking. "We've got to do something," I said. Jean grabbed a towel, and we wrapped the little fellow up until only its nose was sticking out, its huge eyes staring from the shadows in disbelief. "Let's give it a warm bath," I said. "Maybe that will stop the shivering." I filled the staff room sink with warm water, testing it with my elbow as I clutched the kitten in my arms. It slid into the sink like a block of ice. Jean found some shampoo in the art closet, and I rubbed the kitten slowly and lovingly, almost petting it. As the water turned grayer and grayer, the kitten's wild shivering turned to soft purring. I smiled. This kitten was tough, but it was so very young. When I finally lifted it out of the sink, it looked like a newborn, huge lidded eyes and big ears sticking out from a tiny head and an even smaller body. Wet, defenseless, and meowing quietly for its mother. We dried it with the blow dryer we used for drying glue at craft time. Within 30 seconds, I was holding a beautiful, long-haired orange tabby. The kitten had been so filthy, I had thought it was gray. By this time, Doris and Kim had arrived, and there were four people in the staff room, each cooing over the kitten. Eight hands touched it, seemingly at once. The other three staffers talked over one another while I stood silently cradling the kitten like a baby and rocking back and forth from foot to foot. "Where did it come from? The drop box? No. Is it a boy or a girl?" I glanced up. They were all looking at me. "A boy," I said. "He's beautiful. How old is he? How did he get in the box?" I wasn't listening. I only had eyes for the kitten. "It's so cold, bitterly cold. The coldest morning of the year." A pause, then, "Someone must have put him in the box." "That's awful." "Maybe they were trying to save him from the cold." "I don't know. He's so helpless. He's so young." "He's so beautiful. Oh, he's breaking my heart." I put him down on the table. The poor kitten could barely stand. The pads on all four of his paws were frostbitten, and over the next week they would turn white and peel off. And yet the kitten managed to do something truly amazing. He steadied himself on the table and slowly looked up into each face. Then he began to hobble. As each person reached to pet him, he rubbed his tiny head against her hand and purred. Forget the horrible events in his young life. Forget the cruel person who shoved him down that library drop box. It was as if, from that moment on, he wanted to personally thank every person he ever met for saving his life. By now it had been 20 minutes since I pulled the kitten out of the drop box, and I'd had plenty of time to think through a few things. The once common practice of keeping library cats, my ongoing plan to make the library more friendly and appealing, the logistics of bowls and food and cat litter, the trusting expression on the kitten's face when he burrowed into my chest and looked up into my eyes. So I was more than prepared when someone finally asked, "What should we do with him?" "Well," I said, as if the thought had just occurred to me, "maybe we can keep him." The most amazing thing about the kitten was how happy he was that first day. Here he was, in a new environment, surrounded by eager strangers who wanted nothing more than to squeeze him, fondle him, and coo over him, and he was perfectly calm. No matter how many times we passed him from hand to hand, and no matter what position we held him in, he was never jumpy or fidgety. He never tried to bite or get away. Instead, he just melted into each person's arms and stared up into her eyes. And that was no small feat, because we didn't leave him alone for a second. If someone had to set him down, for instance, because there was actual work to do, there were always at least 5 sets of hands ready to grab him, hold him, and love him. In fact, when I set him down at closing time that first night, I had to watch him for 5 minutes to make sure he could totter all the way to his food dish and litter box. I don't think his poor frostbitten feet had touched the ground all day. The next morning, Doris Armstrong brought in a warm pink blanket. Doris was the grandparent on staff, our mother hen. We all watched as she bent down and scratched the kitten under the chin, then folded the blanket and put it in a cardboard box. The kitten stepped gingerly into the box and curled his legs underneath his body for warmth. His eyes closed in blissful contentment, but he had only a few seconds to rest before someone snatched him up and wrapped him in her arms. A few seconds, but it was enough. The staff had been polarized for years. Now we were all making accommodations, coming together as a family, and the kitten was clearly happy to call the library home. It wasn't until late the second morning that we finally shared our little guy with someone outside the staff. That person was Mary Houston, Spencer's local historian and a member of the library board. The staff may already have accepted the kitten, but keeping him wasn't our decision. The previous day I had called the mayor, Squeege Chapman, who was in his last month in office. As I suspected, he didn't care. Squeege wasn't a reader. I'm not even sure he knew Spencer had a library. The city attorney, my second call, didn't know of any statutes barring animals from the library and didn't feel compelled to spend time looking for one. Good enough for me. The library board, a panel of citizens appointed by the mayor to oversee the library, had the final say. They didn't object to the idea of a library cat, but I can't say they were enthusiastic. Their response was more, "Let's give it a try," than, "Heck yeah, we're behind you 100%. That's why meeting a board member like Mary was so important. Agreeing to have an animal in the library was one thing. Agreeing on this animal was another thing entirely. I had no doubt about our boy. From the moment he looked up into my eyes that first morning, so calm and content, I knew he was right for the library. "There he is," Mary exclaimed with a smile. I held him a little more tightly as she reached out to pet him on the top of the head, but he didn't even stiffen. Instead, he stretched out his neck to sniff her hand. "Oh, my," Mary said, "he's handsome." Handsome. I heard it over and over again the next few days, because there was no other way to describe him. This was a handsome cat. His coat was a mix of vibrant orange and white, with subtle, darker stripes. It grew longer as he got older, but as a kitten, it was thick and stylishly long only around his neck. A lot of cats have pointy noses, or their mouths jut out a bit too far, or they're a little lopsided. But this kitten's face was perfectly proportioned. And his eyes, those huge golden eyes. But it wasn't just his looks that made him beautiful. It was also his personality. If you cared at all about cats, you just had to hold him. There was something in his face, in the way he looked at you, that called out for love. "He likes to be cradled," I said, gently sliding him into Mary's arms. "No, on his back. That's right, like a baby." "A 1-pound baby. I don't think he even weighs that much." The kitten shook his tail and nestled down into Mary's arms. He didn't just trust the library staff instinctively, it turned out. He trusted everyone. "Oh, Vicky," Mary said, "he's adorable. What's his name?" "We're calling him Dewey, after Melville Dewey, but we haven't really decided on a name yet." "Hi, Dewey. Do you like the library?" Dewey stared into Mary's face, then pushed his head against her arm. Mary looked up with a smile. I could hold him all day. But, of course, she didn't. She put Dewey back into my arms, and I took him around the corner. The entire staff was waiting for us. That went well, I said. One down, 10,000 to go. Slowly, we started introducing Dewey to a few regulars known to love cats. He was still weak, so we passed him directly into their arms. Marcy Mucky came in that second day, instantly smitten. Mike Bear and his wife Peg loved him. This is a great idea, they said, which was nice to hear, since Mike was on the library board. Pat Jones and Judy Johnson thought him adorable. A week later, Dewey's story ran on the front page of the Spencer Daily Reporter, under the headline, Perfect Addition Made to Spencer Library. The article, which took up half the page, told the story of Dewey's miraculous rescue and was accompanied by a color photograph of a tiny orange kitten staring shyly but confidently into the camera from atop an old-fashioned pull-drawer card catalog. Publicity is a dangerous thing. For a week, Dewey had been a secret between the library staff and a few select patrons. If you didn't come into the library, you didn't know about him. Now, everyone in town knew. Most people, even library regulars, didn't give Dewey a second thought. There were two groups, though, that were thrilled by his arrival. The cat lovers and the children. Just the smiles on the faces of the children, their excitement and laughter, were enough to convince me Dewey should stay. Then there were the complainers. I was a little disappointed, I must admit, but not surprised. There is nothing on God's green earth that someone won't complain about, including both God and green earth. One woman took particular offense. Her letter, sent to me and every member of the city council, was pure fire and brimstone, full of images of children keeling over from sudden asthma attacks and pregnant mothers spontaneously miscarrying when exposed to kitty litter. According to the letter, I was a murderous madwoman who was not only threatening the health of every innocent child in town, born or unborn, but also destroying the social fabric of the community. An animal? In a library? Far more important to me, though, were the worried phone calls. My child has allergies. What am I going to do? He loves the library, one woman said. I knew that would be the most common concern, so I was prepared. Spencer didn't have an allergist, so I solicited the advice of two general practice doctors. The Spencer Public Library, they noted, was a large, open space sectioned off by rows of 4-foot-high shelves. The staff area, my office, and the supply closets were enclosed by a temporary wall, leaving 6 feet open to the ceiling. There were two door-size openings in that wall, and since neither had a door, they were always accessible. Even the staff area was an open space, with desks pushed back-to-back or separated by bookshelves. Not only did this layout allow Dewey easy access to the safety of the staff area at all times, but the doctors assured me it would also prevent the buildup of dander and hair. The library, apparently, was perfectly designed to prevent allergies. If anyone on staff had been allergic, it might have been a problem, but a few hours of exposure every couple of days? The doctors agreed there was nothing to worry about. I spoke personally with each concerned caller and passed on this professional assessment. The parents were skeptical, of course, but most brought their children to the library for a trial run. I held Dewey in my arms for each visit. I not only didn't know how the parents would react, I didn't know how Dewey would react, because the children were so excited to see him. Their mothers would tell them to be quiet, be gentle. The children would approach slowly, tentatively, and whisper, "Hi, Dewey," and then explode with squeals as their mothers ushered them away with a quick, "That's enough." Dewey didn't mind the noise. He was the calmest kitten I'd ever seen. He did mind, I think, that these children weren't allowed to pet him. But a few days later, one family was back, this time with a camera. And this time, the allergic little boy, the object of such concern for the mother, was sitting beside Dewey, petting him, while his mother took pictures. "Justin can't have pets," she told me. "I never knew how much he missed them. He loves Dewey already." I loved Dewey already, too. We all loved Dewey. How could you resist his charm? He was beautiful, loving, social, and still limping on his tiny frostbitten feet. What I couldn't believe was how much Dewey loved us, how comfortable he seemed around strangers. His attitude seemed to be, "How can anyone not love a cat?" Or, more simply, "How can anyone resist me?" Dewey didn't think of himself, I soon realized, as just another cat. He thought of himself, correctly, as one of a kind. Dewey was a fortunate cat. He not only survived the freezing library drop box, but also fell into the arms of a staff that loved him, and a library perfectly designed to care for him. There were no two ways about it. Dewey led a charmed life. But Spencer was also lucky, because Dewey couldn't have fallen into our lives at a better time. That winter wasn't just bitterly cold, it was one of the worst times in Spencer's history. Those who lived in larger cities may not remember the farm crisis of the 1980s. Maybe you remember Willie Nelson and Farm Aid. Maybe you remember reading about the collapse of family farming, about the nation moving from small growers to large factory farms that stretch for miles without a farmhouse or even a farm worker in sight. For most people, it was just a story, not something that affected them directly. In Spencer, you could feel it, in the air, in the ground, in every spoken word. We had a solid manufacturing base, but we were still a farm town. We supported and were supported by farmers, and on the farms, things were falling apart. Almost half the farms in northwest Iowa went into foreclosure in the 1980s. Most of the new owners were giant farming conglomerates, out-of-state speculators, or insurance companies. In 1985, Land O'Lakes, the giant butter and margarine manufacturer, pulled out of the plant on the north edge of town. Soon after, unemployment reached 10%, which doesn't sound too bad until you realize that the population of Spencer had fallen from 11,000 to 8,000 in just a few years. The value of houses dropped 25%, seemingly overnight. People were leaving the county, even the state of Iowa, looking for jobs. The library did what it could. We set up a job bank that contained all our job listings and books on job skills, job descriptions, and technical training. We set up a computer so local men and women could create resumes and cover letters. This was the first computer most of these people had ever seen. It was almost depressing how many people used the job bank. And if it was depressing for an employed librarian, just think how depressing it was for a laid-off factory worker, bankrupt small business owner, or out-of-work farmhand. Then, into our laps, fell Dewey. I don't want to make too much of this one turn of events, because Dewey didn't put food on anyone's table, he didn't create jobs, he didn't turn our economy around. But one of the worst things about bad times is the effect on your mind. Bad times drain you of energy. They occupy your thoughts. They taint everything in your life. Bad news is as poisonous as bad bread. At the very least, Dewey was a distraction. But he was so much more. Dewey's story resonated with the people of Spencer. We identified with it. Hadn't we all been shoved down the library drop box by outside economic forces, by the rest of America, which ate our food but didn't care about the people who grew it? Here was an alley cat, left for dead, in a freezing drop box, terrified, alone, and clinging to life. He made it through that dark night, and that terrible event turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to him. He never lost his trust, no matter what the circumstances, or his appreciation for life. He was humble. Maybe humble isn't the right word. He was a cat, after all. But he wasn't arrogant. He was confident. Maybe it was the confidence of the near-death survivor, the serenity you find when you've been to the end, beyond hope, and made it back. All I knew was that from the moment we found him, Dewey believed everything was going to be fine. And when he was around, he made others believe that, too. It took him 10 days to get healthy enough to explore the library on his own, and once he did, it was clear he had no interest in books, shelves, and other inanimate objects. His interest was people. If there was a patron in the library, he'd walk straight up to him, still slow on his sore feet but no longer hobbling, and jump into his lap. More often than not, he was pushed away, but rejection never deterred him. Dewey kept jumping, kept looking for laps to lie in and hands to pet him, and things started to change. I noticed it first with the older patrons, who often came to the library to flip through magazines or browse for books. Once Dewey started spending time with them, they showed up more frequently and stayed longer. A few seemed better dressed, with more care given to their appearance. They had always given the staff a friendly wave or good morning, but now they engaged us in conversation. And that conversation was usually about Dewey. They couldn't get enough Dewey stories. They weren't just killing time now. They were visiting friends. And then there was the man at the job bank. I didn't know him personally, but I knew his type. Proud, hardworking, resilient. And I knew he was suffering. He was from Spencer, like most of the men who used the job bank, a laborer, not a farmer. His job hunting outfit, like his former work outfit, was jeans and a standard-issue shirt, and he never used the computer. He studied the resume books, he looked through our job listings, he never asked for help. He was quiet, steady, unflappable, but as the weeks passed, I could see the strain in the hunch of his back and the deepening lines on his always clean-shaven face. Every morning, Dewey approached him, but the man always pushed him away. Then one day, I saw Dewey sitting on his lap, and for the first time in weeks, the man was smiling. He was still bent, and there was still sadness in his eyes, but he was smiling. Maybe Dewey couldn't give much, but in the winter of 1988, he gave exactly what Spencer needed. So I gave our kitten to the community. The staff understood. He wasn't our cat, not really. He belonged to the patrons of the Spencer Public Library. I put a box by the front door, right next to the job bank, and told people, "You know the cat who sits on your lap and helps with your resume? The one who reads the newspaper with you? Who steals the lipstick out of your purse and helps you find the fiction section? Well, he's your cat, and I want you to help name him." I had been library director for only 6 months, so I was still enthusiastic about contests. A good contest with a good prize might draw 50 entries. If the prize was expensive, like a television set, we might scrape up 70. Usually we got about 25. Our Name the Kitty contest received 397 entries. 397 entries! That's when I realized the library had stumbled onto something important. Community interest in Dewey was off all our charts. Lasagna-loving Garfield was at the height of his popularity, so Garfield was a popular choice. There were 9 votes for Tiger. Tigger was almost as popular. Morris was another multiple vote-getter, after the 9 Lives spokescat. By far, the most entries, more than 50, were for Dewey. Apparently the patrons had already grown attached to this kitten, and they didn't want him to change, not even his name. And to be honest, the staff didn't either. We too had grown attached to Dewey just the way he was. Still, the name needed something. Our best option, we decided, was to think of a last name. Mary Walk, our children's librarian, suggested Readmore. A commercial running during the Saturday morning cartoons featured a cartoon cat named O.G. Readmore, who encouraged kids to read a book and take a look at the TV in your head. I'm sure that's where the name came from. Dewey Readmore. Close, but not quite. I suggested the last name, Books. Dewey Readmore Books. One name for the librarians, who live by the Dewey Decimal System. One for the children. One for everyone. Dewey Readmore Books. Three names for our regal, confident, beautiful cat. Cats are creatures of habit, and it didn't take long for Dewey to develop a routine. When I arrived at the library every morning, he was waiting for me at the front door. He would take a few bites of his food while I hung up my jacket and bag, and then we would walk the library together, making sure everything was in place and discussing our evenings. Dewey was more a sniffer than a talker, but I didn't mind. The library, once so cold and dead first thing in the morning, was alive and well. After our walk, Dewey would visit the staff, but never for too long. At 9:02, Dewey would drop whatever he was doing and race for the front door. A patron was always waiting outside at 9:00 when we opened the doors, and she would usually enter with a warm, "Hi, Dewey, how are you this morning?" It wouldn't take long for him to find a lap, and since he'd been up for 2 hours, that usually meant it was time for a quick nap. Dewey was already so comfortable in the library, he had no problem falling asleep in public places. He preferred laps, of course, but if they weren't available, he would curl up in a box. The cards for the catalog came in small boxes about the size of a pair of baby shoes. Dewey liked to cram all 4 feet inside, sit down, and let his sides ooze over the edge. If the box was a little bigger, he buried his head and tail in the bottom. The only thing you could see was a big blob of back fur sticking out of the top. He looked like a muffin. One morning, I found Dewey sleeping beside a box full of cards with one paw resting inside. It probably took him hours to reluctantly admit there wasn't room for anything else. Soon after, I watched him slowly wind his way into a half-empty tissue box. He put his 2 front feet through the slit on top, then delicately stepped in with the other 2. Slowly he sat down on his hind legs and rolled his back end until it was wedged into the box. Then he started bending his front legs and working the front of his body into the crease. The operation took 4 or 5 minutes, but finally, there was nothing left but his head sticking out in one direction and his tail sticking out in the other. I watched as he stared half-lidded into the distance, pretending the rest of the world didn't exist. Dewey's other favorite resting spot was the back of the copier. "Don't worry," I told the confused patrons. "You can't disturb him. He sleeps there because it's warm. The more copies you make, the more heat the machine produces, the happier he'll be." If the patrons weren't quite sure what to do with Dewey yet, the staff had no such hesitation. One of my first decisions was that no library funds, not one penny, would ever be spent on Dewey's care. Instead, we kept a Dewey box in the back room. Everyone on staff tossed in their loose change. Most of us also brought in soda cans from home. Recycling soda cans was all the rage, and one of the clerks, Cynthia Behrens, would take the cans to a drop-off point every week. The whole staff was feeding the kitty to feed the kitty. In return for these small contributions, we'd get endless hours of pleasure. Dewey loved drawers, and he developed a habit of popping out of them when you least expected. If you were shelving books, he'd jump onto the cart and demand a trip around the library. And when Kim Peterson, the library secretary, started typing, you knew a show was about to begin. As soon as I heard those keys, I'd put down my work and wait for the signal. "Dewey's after the clacker thingies again," Kim would call out. I'd hurry out of my office to find Dewey hunched on the back edge of Kim's big white typewriter. His head would be jerking from side to side as the disk moved left to right, then back again, until finally he couldn't take it anymore and lunged at the clacker thingies, which were nothing more than the keys rising up to strike the paper. The whole staff would be there, watching and laughing. Dewey's antics always drew a crowd. But no matter how much fun Dewey was having, he never forgot his routine. At exactly 10:30, he would hop up and head for the staff room. Jean Hollis Clark ate yogurt on her break, and if he hung around long enough, she'd let him lick the lid. Jean was quiet and hard-working, but she always found ways to accommodate Dewey. If Dewey wanted downtime, he would lie limply over Jean's left shoulder, and only her left shoulder, never her right, while she filed papers. After a few months, Dewey wouldn't let us hold him cradled in our arms anymore, too much like a baby, I suppose, so the whole staff adopted Jean's over-the-shoulder technique. We called it the Dewey carry. Dewey helped me with downtime, too, which was nice, since I had a tendency to work too hard. Many days I'd be hunched over my desk for hours, so intent on budget numbers or progress reports that I wouldn't even realize Dewey was there until he sprang into my lap. "How you doing, baby boy?" I'd say with a smile. "So nice to see you." I'd pet him a few times before turning back to my work. Unsatisfied, he'd climb on my desk and start sniffing. "Oh, you just happened to sit on the paper I'm working on, didn't you? Purely a coincidence." I put him on the floor. He hopped back up. "Not now, Dewey. I'm busy." I put him back down. He hopped back up. Maybe if I ignored him. He pushed his head against my pencil. I pushed him aside. "Fine," he thought. "I'll knock these pens to the ground." Which he proceeded to do, one pen at a time, watching each one fall. I couldn't help but laugh. "Okay, Dewey, you win." I wadded up a piece of paper and threw it to him. He ran after it, sniffed it, then came back. Typical cat. Always one to play, never one to fetch. I walked over, picked up the paper, tossed it a few more times. "What am I going to do with you?" But it wasn't all jokes and games. I was the boss, and I had responsibilities. Like giving the cat a bath. The first time I bathed Dewey, I was confident things would go well. He loved the bath that first morning, right? This time, Dewey slid into the sink like a block of ice dropped into a vat of acid. He thrashed. He screamed. He put his feet on the edge of the sink and tried to throw his body over the side. I held him down with both arms. 20 minutes later, I was covered with water. My hair looked like I had stuck my tongue in a light socket. Everybody laughed, including, eventually, me. The third bath was just as bad. I managed to get Dewey scrubbed, but I didn't have the patience for toweling and blow-drying. Not this crazy kitten. "Fine," I told him. "If you hate it that much, just go." Dewey was a vain cat. He would spend an hour washing his face until he got it just right. The funniest part was the way he would ball up his fist, lick it, and shove it into his ears. He would work those ears until they were sparkling white. Now, soaking wet, he looked like a chihuahua crushed by a wave of toupees. It was pathetic. The staff was laughing and taking pictures, but Dewey looked so genuinely upset that after a few minutes the pictures stopped. "Have a sense of humor, Dew," I teased him. "You brought this on yourself." He curled up behind a shelf of books and didn't come out for hours. After that, Dewey and I agreed that 2 baths a year were plenty. "The bath is nothing," I told Dewey a few months into his stay at the library, wrapping him up in his green towel. "You're not going to like this at all." Dewey never rode in a cage. It was too much like that night in the box. Whenever I took him out of the library, I just wrapped him up in his green towel. 5 minutes later, we arrived at Dr. Esterly's office at the other end of town. "Hi, Dewey," he said, checking him over. "Do you think this is absolutely necessary, doctor?" "Cats need to be neutered." I looked down at Dewey's tiny paws, which had finally healed. There were tufts of fur sticking out from between his toes. "Do you think he's part Persian?" "No, he's just a good-looking alley cat." I didn't believe it for a second. "Dewey is a product of survival of the fittest," Dr. Esterly continued. "His ancestors have probably lived in that alley for generations."
"So he's one of us?"
Dr. Esterly smiled.
"I suppose so."
He picked Dewey up and held him under his arm. Dewey was relaxed and purring. The last thing Dr. Esterly said before they disappeared around the corner was,
"Dewey is one fine cat."
He sure was, and I missed him already. When I picked Dewey up the next morning, my heart almost broke in two. He had a faraway look in his eyes and a little shaved belly. I took him in my arms. He pushed his head against my arm and started purring. He was so happy to see his old pal, Vicky. I could almost hear him saying, "Where have you been? I missed you." I cradled him against my chest. I don't know if I said it out loud or to myself, but it didn't matter. Dewey could already read my moods, if not my mind.
"I'm your mama, aren't I?"
Dewey put his head on my shoulder, right up against my neck, and purred. Don't get me wrong. Everything wasn't perfect with the Dew. Yes, he was a sweet and beautiful cat, and yes, he was extraordinarily trusting and generous, but he was still a kitten. He'd streak maniacally through the staff room. He'd knock your work to the floor out of pure playfulness. He was too immature to know who really needed him, and he sometimes wouldn't take no for an answer when a patron wanted to be left alone. At story hour, his presence made the children so rambunctious and unpredictable that Mary Walk, our children's librarian, banned him from the room. Then there was Mark, a large puppet of a child with muscular dystrophy. We used Mark to teach schoolchildren about disabilities. There was so much cat hair on Mark's legs that we finally had to put him in a closet. Dewey worked all night until he figured out how to open that closet and went right back to sleeping on Mark's lap. We bought a lock for the closet the next day. But nothing compared to his behavior around catnip. Doris Armstrong was always bringing Dewey presents, such as little balls or toy mice. One day, near the end of Dewey's first summer, she quite innocently brought in a bag of fresh catnip. Dewey was so excited by the smell, I thought he was going to climb her leg. For the first time in his life, the cat actually begged. When Doris finally crumbled a few leaves on the floor, Dewey went crazy. He started smelling them so hard, I thought he was going to inhale the floor. After a few sniffs, he started sneezing, but he didn't slow down. Instead, he started chewing the leaves, then alternating back and forth, chewing, sniffing, chewing, sniffing. His muscles started to ripple, a slow cascade of tension flowing out of his bones and down his back. When he finally shook that tension out the end of his tail, he flopped over on the ground and rolled back and forth in the catnip. He rolled until he lost every bone in his body. Unable to walk, he slithered on the floor, undulating as he rubbed his chin along the carpet like a snowplow blade. I mean, the cat oozed. Then gradually, his spine bent backward in slow motion until his head was resting on his behind. He formed figure eights, zigzags, pretzels. I swear the front half of his body wasn't even connected to the back half. Doris and I looked at each other in amazement, then burst out laughing. My goodness, it was funny. Dewey's other interest, besides puppets, drawers, boxes, copiers, typewriters, and catnip, was rubber bands. Dewey was absolutely fanatical about rubber bands. He didn't even need to see them. He could smell them across the library. As soon as you put a box of rubber bands on your desk, he was there. Here you go, Dewey, I would say as I opened a new bag. One for you and one for me. He would take his rubber band in his mouth and happily skip away. I would find it the next morning in his litter box. It looked like a worm poking its head out of a chunk of dirt. I thought, that can't be good. Dewey always attended staff meetings, but fortunately, he wasn't yet able to understand what we were talking about. A few years down the road, that cat and I were able to have long philosophical conversations. But for right now, it was easy to wrap up the meeting with a simple reminder. Don't give Dewey any more rubber bands. I don't care how much he begs, he's been eating them, and I have a feeling rubber isn't the healthiest food for a growing kitten. The next day, there were more rubber band worms in Dewey's litter. And the next. And the next. At the next staff meeting, I was more direct. Is anyone giving Dewey rubber bands? No. 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 Then he must be stealing them. From now on, don't leave rubber bands lying out on your desk. Easier said than done. Much, much easier said than done. You would be amazed how many rubber bands there are in a library. We all put our rubber band holders away, but that didn't even dent the problem. Rubber bands apparently are sneaky critters. They slide under computer keyboards and crawl into your pencil holder. They fall under your desk and hide in the wires. One evening, I caught Dewey rummaging through a stack of work on someone's desk. There was a rubber band lurking every time he pushed a piece of paper aside. Even the hidden ones need to go, I said at the next staff meeting. Let's clean up those desks and put them away. Remember, Dewey can smell rubber. In a few days, the staff area looked neater than it had in years. So, Dewey started raiding the rubber bands left out on the circulation desk for patrons. We stashed them in a drawer. He found the rubber bands by the copier, too. The patrons were just going to have to ask for rubber bands. A small price to pay, I thought, in exchange for a cat who spent most of his day trying to make them happy. Soon, our counter-operation was showing signs of success. There were still worms in the litter box, but not nearly as many. And Dewey was being forced into brazenness. Every time I pulled out a rubber band, he was watching me. Getting desperate, are we? No, no, just seeing what's going on. As soon as I put the rubber band down, Dewey pounced. I pushed him away, and he sat on the desk waiting for his chance. Not this time, Dewey, I said with a grin. I admit it, this game was fun. Dewey became more subtle. One afternoon, I was walking past our big floor-to-ceiling supply cabinet. I was focused on something else, probably budget numbers, and only noticed the open door out of the corner of my eye. Did I just see? I turned around and walked back to the cabinet. Sure enough, there was Dewey, sitting on a shelf at eye level, a huge rubber band hanging out of his mouth. You can't stop the Dew. I'm going to be feasting for a week. A few mornings later, I found file cards sitting suspiciously unbound on the front desk. Dewey had never gone for tight rubber bands before. Now he was biting them off every night. As always, he was delicate, even in defiance. He left perfectly neat stacks, not a card out of place. The cards went into the drawers. The drawers were shut tight. By the fall of 1988, you could spend an entire day in the Spencer Public Library without seeing a rubber band. Oh, they were still there, but they were squirreled away where only those with an opposing